This is a CBC podcast.
Hi there, it's Pia, and every Wednesday, we're bringing you a bonus podcast, one handpicked story from the week's round of the Sunday magazine that we think is definitely worth hearing or hearing again. Of course, you can hear all of our stories on the full podcast that we put out on Sunday and on the CBC Listen app. All right, here's this week's highlight. Depending on who you are, you may have come to know the name Rex Chapman in different ways. Maybe it's for being a college basketball superstar who went on to play in the NBA in the era of Michael Jordan, Kobe Bryant, Steve Nash. Maybe you're one of his millions of followers on social media, where he regularly brings people joy by sharing funny and inspiring stories and videos. Or perhaps you know Rex from a low point between those high when his mugshot made the news after he was arrested for stealing to fund his addictions. Rex Chapman opens up about it all in a new memoir. It is called It's Hard for Me to Live With Me. Rex, hi. It's great to have a chance to talk with you.
Hi, Pia. Thanks for having me.
It's nice to have you. We'll get to your title in a sec. But, you know, I used the word joy just now. And to me, that's really a bookend of sorts to your story. So maybe we can start at the beginning with one of your earliest joys, and that's basketball. Your dad was a basketball coach, and so the game was sort of in your blood. What was it that you loved about basketball from such a young age, despite your dad being in the game?
Yeah, wow. I guess I just liked being out there. I had a real, like, I couldn't wait to be big. When I was little, like 5, 6, 7, I couldn't wait to be a high schooler. I was felt like I was wasting my time as a kid. I couldn't wait to play high school basketball and do like the big kids were doing. And so, yeah, basketball was just sort of, I loved it. I had fun doing it. I could never get enough of it. That's all I ever thought about. It's all I ever wanted to do.
And so when did you, as you were playing and always, I'm sure, out on a driveway or in a court in your neighborhood or telling your friends, come on, let's go play some ball. When did you realize, like, I not only love this thing, but I'm pretty good at this thing too?
Yeah, very early. Like, 6, 7, 8 years old. I guess growing up, going to my father's practices and watching his players, you know, dribble behind their back and between their legs. And I started emulating that stuff before I really knew it was hard. So by the time I got into school, they would move me up, you know, grade levels to play against older kids for most of my life from the time I was in first grade on. So I was always playing against older kids, and that was kind of my comfort level. And basketball wise, I could keep up. Socially, not so much.
So just for people who don't understand Kentucky to the level that you do, that's where you're from. That's where you are today. It is one thing to be good at basketball. It's another to be great at it in Kentucky, in your home state.
Yeah.
For people who don't follow the sport, Kentucky is, I don't know how I would put it other than saying basketball mad. Is that fair?
Oh, yeah. Basketball crazy. It's like, it's a it really is like a religion here. It's a split state, Kentucky, University of Kentucky and University of Louisville, only it's not that split. A lot of people in the city of Louisville and their surrounding areas are big Cardinals fans, but everywhere else, it's strictly Kentucky, University of Kentucky, blue and white. For the most part. So there were no professional teams when I was growing up, and still no professional franchises other than minor league baseball and maybe minor league hockey in Kentucky. There's no MLB, no NFL, no NBA. So these college, Louisville and Kentucky, those are kind of our pro teams that the state, you know, likes to be represented by. Weirdly, I grew up a Louisville fan. I was not a Kentucky diehard growing up. So that was my dream school. Once I guess I got to be a sophomore, junior in high school, then everybody kind of started recruiting me. In the end, I visited, you know, several schools and chose Kentucky in the end.
And Rex, you know, representing is great. And it also comes kind of with some expectations and some burdens. And I should just point out for our listeners who might not know you or might not know what you look like, you're a white guy playing basketball.
Right.
And that's important because it's important to the story of your life. Your relationship with your home state of Kentucky for a long time, and maybe still is, Rex, is complex. So can you kind of just walk me through that?
Yeah. So I think for different reasons it is. I left school early in an era where kids didn't really do that. I played 2 years at Kentucky, and when I left high school, I'd planned on playing 4 years in college. I wasn't thinking about the NBA. Also, in high school, my high school sweetheart's a girl named Sean Higgs, and we're still very good friends. Sean's black, and we got a lot of pushback from that in our hometown, and kind of hid that during high school, hid as much as we could, and kind of cruised around at nighttime and spent time with each other in private, but people didn't really like it. And Sean was also, her brother was an NFL player. He's a year older than us. He was a great football player at the University of Kentucky. We were all at Kentucky together. Sean went to Kentucky too. She was a two-time state track champion in the 100-meter dash. So she went to Kentucky. And when I got to Kentucky, very quickly after she and I had been walking to class for a few days, I was called in and cautioned that if I wanted to see Sean, that was okay, but I needed to do it in private. We didn't need to be seen publicly together. And that really messed me up. I thought it was a joke at first, and then I realized that it wasn't. That was something that was very difficult to deal with while I was in school. And while I was in school, I probably had another, 5-6 times that I was called in for those types of talks. And it was very confusing, because the basketball part was going well for me. I didn't have any issues with that. It was just, I started questioning myself at the time, wondering if I'm a bad person for dating who I'm dating, because they're sure making it sound like I shouldn't be doing it. So yeah, just young and very immature, and didn't know how to, really negotiate any of that.
You used a couple of words. You said, I got pushback and people cautioned me. And you write quite extensively about this in the book. So can you just kind of frame what that pushback or the caution sounded like?
Well, to me, it sounded like, hey, you're a white All-American basketball player. We can't afford to have you seen with a black girl in public. And that was what the message was that I was hearing. And it's one thing for me to internalize that and as a teenager and try to make sense of it. But I had to leave that meeting and every meeting and go tell Sean what was going on. And yeah, sure, it's hurtful to me. But imagine, they didn't even meet her and they're telling me I can't see her. It was institutional racism that I didn't know that there was even a term for that at the time. Maybe there wasn't. I have no idea. I just felt trapped. She felt trapped, and we both felt very, very wronged. And then on top of that, most of my teammates, most of her brother's teammates, Mark's teammates, were black. A lot of those athletes were dating white girls, but they weren't being discouraged from doing so. So I always found that I was conflicted by that, and still am. Still am.
Yeah, that's a lot to process at any point in your life, but you're a teenager and there's a lot going on, and you're a superstar basketball player. So there's lots of just pressure from that. And within that context, Rex, you also, you got your skill, you got your adulation, you've got this girlfriend that you really, really care for, but other people are saying, I know you care for her, but yeah, maybe not so much.
Right.
The other thing that you write about in the book a lot is, as you're being celebrated, you get away with a lot of things. You describe not getting punished for cheating on a test or setting fire to a hotel room, getting preferential treatment by police. It sort of ratchets up as you tell your story. All of this because you were a burgeoning basketball star, but also because of the color of your skin.
Yeah.
How did you come to understand that position, that privilege, as you were sort of coming up through high school and almost at the NBA?
It started being very weird because I was pulled over a lot because I would speed everywhere I went. I was very impatient. And I mean, it was nothing for me to go 130 on the freeway, just really idiotic behavior. But there were several times I was pulled over. And I remember one time in particular, I was going 128 on I-75. And I was flying back from Northern Kentucky where I'd spoken at a camp. And I had two of my high school buddies in the car with me, and we're flying back down I-75, and a cop pulls me over, and we're like, oh, crap, you know. And he pulls me over, and he taps on the window, and I hand him my license, and he looks at it and goes, Rex? And I said, yeah. He said, my wife would kill me if I gave you a ticket. Be safe and head on. And my friends, I just remember them going, oh, my God, that license, it's a get-out-of-jail-free card. I was like, wow, I guess so. We were 18, 19-year-old kids and getting away with stuff, you know, or I was, that, you know, somebody should have taken me to jail for going 130. Made an example, taught me a lesson at that point, but I didn't, you know, it was just the time and the era, I guess. Pre-internet, too, so.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah. Your mugshot wouldn't have been on any internet at that point.
Right.
So that's a context you kind of come up in, Rex. You're mm-hmm. being excellent and lauded, but also seeing the shadow side of privilege and success.
Right.
Then in 1988, the big breakthrough happens for you. You're drafted by the NBA, by the Hornets, Charlotte Hornets. How did all that context inform your worldview as you go pro? Because you made it, quote unquote, right, by then?
Well, yeah, but I didn't want to leave school. I was not ready to leave school socially, emotionally. I'd always had a roommate in college, and before that, I slept in my parents' house. And so I wasn't really interested in leaving. Also, I was not enjoying being at school, being told who I could date and who I couldn't date. So I entered the draft, and I was drafted 8th overall in the first pick of the Charlotte Hornets. And I got to Charlotte, and I guess the first or second time I met with the owner, I was holding out for a little bit more money. The owner, I was at his house, and he took me downstairs and poured me a Coke. I didn't drink. And he said, hey, do you have a black girlfriend? And I didn't. Sean and I were broken up at the time. And I said, no, I don't. But if I did, and that makes me a bad guy, then I guess I'll just be a bad guy. And it was the first time I had ever really stood up for myself. And he started backpedaling, said, no, it's just, I don't care. We just live down here in the Bible Belt. Same thing people have been saying to me for years now. And
that they don't mind, but others will.
Yeah, others will. And when he said Bible Belt, I had never heard that term before. I'm from Kentucky, and I don't know if that's considered the Bible Belt, but they sure considered North Carolina that, and I heard that a lot. But when I heard that, I went, oh, man. So people that read the Bible in this part of the country aren't going to like me because of who I'm dating. It was just really confusing. And honestly, I felt like it was morally wrong what they were saying. And so naturally, I placed judgment on these people at a young age that, you know, these are not good people, when, you know, that's not necessarily the case. They're just, you know, it's just how they've been brought up. And there is a lot of, you know, church stuff that goes into what, you know, some of these folks think. So it was just very confusing. And I was young. And again, I had left Kentucky and thought I was leaving that behind. And it just followed me right to Charlotte.
If you're just joining us on this Sunday morning, I'm speaking with Rex Chapman, retired NBA basketball player, who's also known these days for shining on social media. Rex, you know, if that was your story, you wouldn't have written a book, right? A guy grew up in Kentucky and became an NBA player. And that's the end of the story.
Yeah, yeah.
Your story is much deeper. It is much more complicated. You spent 12 years in the NBA in a career filled with many highs. There were also big lows, including injuries, which is common amongst professional athletes. Yep. And I'm not going to be able to go through everyone, but the important thing about injuries is usually the other side of that is that there is something to take care of the pain.
Right.
So how did you first encounter painkillers?
Oh, man. I'd taken painkillers on and off probably throughout my career, but nothing where it was a problem. I'd have a surgery and, you know, they'd put me on Vicodin for a couple of days and then I'd be off of that. But my last 3 years, I had 7 surgeries total, and a lot of in and out of the hospital, a lot of rehab and a lot of pain medication. But I had always gotten off the pain medication in a couple of days because I needed to know my body and I needed to know how it felt, because I'm trying to get back out there and play as soon as I can. I had an emergency appendectomy in my 12th year. I still had 3 years remaining on a contract that was paying me another $13 or $14 million total. The doctor gave me a 30-day supply of OxyContin, a brand new drug, and said, take this, trust me. And I was like, Well, okay. So I took it, and really, in a day or two, I was in love. It was the greatest thing I'd ever had. All that anxiety and social anxiety and all that went away. I felt funnier and better, better dad, better husband, smarter husband. I felt like it was what I was missing my whole life. I've always not been the biggest fan of people walking up that I don't know and starting to chit chat about basketball or whatever. And when I took that medicine, all that went away, and I honestly felt like a nicer person. I felt like, I'm giving people, what they want when they come up to talk to me, that finally I'm able to do that. Well, as we know with drugs, normally drugs are fun at first, and then it's drugs and problems, and then it's just problems after a while. And that happened for me very quickly. In a matter of 18 months, I was taking 40 Vicodin a day and 10 OxyContin a day, just chewing them up, eating them, no water, no nothing, just to get them in my system as fast as I could. And that started just a 14, 15-year battle with opioids in and out of rehabs.
You write that taking Oxy made you feel invincible. You also say that, quote, it's the biggest lie there is. And you write about the doctors. You shopped around. You just got the pills wherever you could who were prescribing you opioids. And you call them, quote, legal drug dealers.
Well, I mean, oh, we could talk about this forever. Purdue Pharma is the one that unleashed this opioid epidemic on America through OxyContin, and it was too good. That drug is too good to be on the street. Just especially given people for routine operations like appendicitis. It's negligent. OxyContin is a monster. It's a I always felt like it was the it'll be all right drug, because all of your bad thoughts are very fleeting, and it seems like the good ones stay around for a while. But it's a big lie. This you've got to keep taking more and more and more of it to get, the feeling that you're searching for. And I was just very fortunate because I was in rehab quite a bit, and I've heard all the stories. And honest to goodness, I was just very fortunate that I had bottomed out before I started using heroin and before I started going to a needle, which that's the next step once you're, really out of money, because it's cheap and then it's dangerous. And then coming back from that is very, very difficult.
Let's talk about your bottom. You left the NBA in 2000. You wrote that the only thing I give a shit about is those opioids. It is the first time in my life that I want something more than basketball. Rex Chapman, you made $40 million US playing professional basketball, and within a few years, you're sleeping in your car.
My ex-wife, who's just amazing, Bridget, we were married for 20 years. We have four terrific kids. She raised them, and I played with them. But she's a saint, and we'd gotten divorced, so there's some of the money, but I gambled. I played horses, thoroughbreds, my whole life. I started going to the track with my dad when I was about 5 or 6 years old. It was kind of our little secret. He didn't want me to tell my mom about it, and I never told my mom about it. I just thought that gambling and going to the track is something that dads do, that adults do. I could read a racing form really before I could, read a newspaper in school. So as I got older, and I didn't drink and I didn't smoke, I was very disciplined in that regard. And as a kid growing up in the 80s, the Reagan just say no, all that made me feel really good. Like, I don't do drugs. But the problem was, once I got to college and I started having, personal problems, I was very proud, and I didn't want to talk. I didn't feel like I had anybody I could talk to, because the people in power were the ones that were, making me upset. But what I started doing was coping by going to the track. If I was upset, I'd go to the track, spend 7 hours at the track, betting horses, getting lost in the racing form. And I did that for 25 years. That was an escape for me, not a good escape, but it was how I coped with things. And I knew I had a problem, but I was not willing to do anything about it.
So you got to fuel your drug addiction and pay for it. And In 2014, you were arrested for shoplifting from an Apple store. It's not the first shoplifting endeavor that you did. Your mugshot's taken. It makes the news. You plead guilty to 4 felony charges. You're sentenced to probation. We talk about people's low points or lowest points or rock bottom or all those sort of, I don't know, cliche euphemisms. That must have been awfully dark for you, Rex.
Well, yeah, I still, every time these interviews come up, this is brought up. Of course it is. But, you know, I have to sit in it for a moment and go, she just said, I pled guilty to felonies and I was shoplifting. That's me you're talking about. I did that. And I still, it's hard to reconcile. It's hard to wrap my head around that. You know, the person I was always before I, you know, got in trouble was, I like to have fun. I might have sped. I did some speeding. This was something, I have to blame it on the drugs, because if I don't blame it on the drugs, then just morally, what's wrong with me? So at that point, I did. I felt like I was at rock bottom. And yes, I was embarrassed. But man, at that point, we have 4 children from ages 10 to 20. And they're in college and some in middle school. I've embarrassed them. I have really, really embarrassed them and my ex-wife and my mother and father and my friends' children who have all looked up to me. I went to rehab, and at that point, I just, you know, and I think it's kind of a credit to my sports background. You just fight. You have to fight. And if you're going to try something, you may as well try really hard. And so I started trying to make a commitment to figuring out why I do the things I do, why I've landed in this spot, and try to get out of it.
So rehab doesn't work the first couple of tries. Usually doesn't for people. But it worked eventually for you. You said, I know I had a problem. Yes, I was embarrassed. And eventually I got help. We know, Rex, and this is the important part of your story. And this is the story you want out in the world. All kinds of people from all kinds of walks of life struggle with addiction. And we have seen in our country and in yours and in your home state of Kentucky, how intensified opioid addiction in particular has become in recent years. There are people out there saying, yep, that's not going to be me, though. That's never going to happen to me. Yeah. So what do you want people listening to take away from, it's not even a chapter of your life, from this part that is still a part of your life?
That was not a thing when I was growing up. You know, cocaine was, weed was, painkillers were not a thing. They just weren't. And I think it does a real disservice to call them painkillers, because most people, I think, associate that with, well, my knee hurts and I need a painkiller for that. That's fine. I understand that. But what ends up happening is people take painkillers and get hooked on painkillers, in my opinion, to numb their emotional pain and to not think about, you know, whatever it is that's bothering them. I certainly did that. I started self-medicating. Once I took OxyContin, again, I had 3 years and $13 million left on the contract, and I never touched a basketball again. I never had the interest to even do that. That still blows me away. The one thing I loved more than anything in the world was basketball. It's the only thing I'd ever done. And obviously, I think at this point, I knew I wasn't going to play that much longer and probably was numbing my worries about not being a basketball player, not having that to do anymore. And now what am I going to do? So I just dove headfirst into the painkillers so I didn't have to think about any of it.
So there are some people listening, saying to whoever's sitting with them this morning, listening to them, saying, hey, Rex Chapman's telling us about addiction and basketball. Is that the same Rex Chapman you follow on like social media and he posts like dolphin videos, which is sort of how a lot of people have come to know you. My friends and I fell in love with your Twitter feed during the pandemic because it was this lovely salve to the terrible times we were all living in. And like Rex, you really did help people through that. And, you know, fast forward 4 years later, and even then, but we know social media can be this terrible, toxic place. You have millions. I don't even know what your follower count is, but it's millions for sharing those funny, inspiring stuff every day. And I just want you to make the case for the good of social media. In other words, like, why do you think people have, no offense, but they're dolphin videos, my friend. And, you know, but yet they seem to be so about so much more than dolphin videos.
Yeah, you know, I think you brought it up. The pandemic, the world was home, terrified. We didn't know if we touched something at the grocery store, if we were going to die. we couldn't see each other in person. And the one thing that we had was the internet. I'm not a feel-good guy. This is actually the point when Seth Davis and I, who co-wrote the book with me, started writing the book. So we're talking about this hard stuff every day during the pandemic, and really for the last 4 years on and off. Meanwhile, when I have a chance, I'll get on Twitter and somebody will have sent me just the most amazing video of a baby laughing or something like that. And I'd be like, oh man, this is great. Put it out, and people liked it. It was giving us, I think, just a little bit of respite from everybody being effing terrified that they were going to die from coronavirus. So I think that that was just a timely thing. And again, I'm not the feel good guy. I have to trick myself into being happy enough to get through every day. So lots of times I'm just looking for something to distract me and get my mind off of my anxiety. And, it seems like that's kind of what that Twitter channel became there for a while.
For a while, because as time sort of moved on, and you still post some of those uplifting videos, but you have been posting more serious stuff too over the last number of years. A lot of stuff about racial inequality, inequity, racism, your views on politics as well. But we kind of started our conversation talking about your relationship from a young age and how you, I think you said, I didn't even like understand like or know what institutionalized racism was. So, what are you trying to say with these posts about your country now in 2024?
I just have regret and shame and guilt for how I handled all that stuff. Yes, I was a teenager. I just wish I would have stood up for myself more. And I see these young people. I saw Stephen Curry, he's my little buddy. I've known him since he was a baby. His dad and
You know his
mom are
dad.
my best friends. Yeah. So he said something the other day on an interview that I saw on social media, and he said, "You know what I'm interested in? I'm in interested in leveraging my influence in any way I can for good." And man, I wish I could have been playing in this era where, you can say things, you can do those sorts of things. We didn't have social media or anything, but I still had a pretty big platform. I could have said anything at any time, and it would have, it would have at least been heard. I hate that I didn't, but I've kind of got a little bit of a second chance to do that now. So I think it would be pretty cowardly of me to not pick my spots here and there.
Take your shot.
Yeah. Yep.
Yeah. So I said we get back to the title of your book.
Yeah.
It's called It's Hard for Me to Live With Me. I started out saying your story has been bookended by joy. You just said, look, I've got a second chance. Is it hard for Rex Chapman to live with Rex Chapman?
Yes. But I mean, I do it. I complain about it and all that stuff, but I'm fine. It's just how I'm wired. The book was supposed to be called, I think, The King and I.
King and I is a reference. You were called King Rex growing up.
Right. And when the publisher read it, Seth Davis, Seth the co-writer, had asked me one day, do you think you'll get married again or, live with somebody? And I said, no, I really don't. And I have a girlfriend and she's great. And we do kind of half live together. But when he said that, I said, no, I don't. I said, it's hard for me to live with me. I wouldn't want to burden anybody else with that. I wish I could take myself in smaller doses. And apparently the publishers read that and they were like, no, that's the title. So
Yeah.
I was like, okay, sure, whatever.
I'm glad you're finding some joy, Rex. Your book, your life story has a lot of life lessons for all of us, and I appreciate you sharing it with us. You didn't have to, and it takes a lot of
Oh,
courage. And thank you for it. Appreciate it.
thank you so much, Pia. I'll do it again sometime, anytime you want.
Rex Chapman is a former NBA star. His new memoir is called It's Hard for Me to Live With Me. You can find all the stories we bring you each week on the Sunday Magazine over on our website, cbc.ca/Sunday. I'm Pia Chattopadhyay. Thank you for lending us your ear, and we'll talk to you again on Sunday.
For more CBC podcasts, go to cbc.ca/podcasts.